discovering stories of courage, determination, and hope. Welcome to Faith Radio's On the Road. Now, here's Ryan Thomas.
Life is short, I want to live it well. One life, one story to tell. Life is short, I want to live it well. And you're the one I'm living for.
To call yourself Christian in the Middle Eastern nations of Iraq and Syria is to live in daily danger. Houses of worship are bombed, pastors are murdered, children are kidnapped. With their dramatic sweep from their Syrian base into Iraq, Islamic State fighters have been brutalizing and annihilating Christians. But why? Where did the terrorists come from? And what can be done to stop them? For more than a decade, journalist Mindy Bells has reported on the ground from the Middle East, giving her unparalleled access to the story no one wants to believe. In They Say We Are Infidels, she brings us inside the stark reality of this escalating genocide, tracking the stories of real-life Christians who refuse to abandon their faith, even in the face of losing everything, including their lives. Welcome to the show, Mindy. It is a real honor to have you here today.
Thank you so much.
Well, I know that the book originally came out last year, and we've been seeing lots of fluctuation in the territory that ISIS commands in both Syria and Iraq. Is it fair to say that there's good news in that story? Are we seeing them beaten back in key areas and their threat perhaps diminished somewhat?
Well, we definitely are, and it is good news. We've seen the Iraq army begin an offensive last fall. They've had a lot of support from our U.S. Air Forces and some advisors on the ground, and they have, you know, successfully routed ISIS, really. At one time, ISIS controlled nearly a third of Iraq at the end of 2014. And at this point, ISIS has been pushed out of Nineveh Plains, which is the area surrounding the city of Mosul, successfully pushed out of Mosul in what was a fierce battle that began at the beginning of this year and didn't end until June, really early July, actually. And now there are just a few remnants. There's the town of Tel Afar where there's still some fighting going on in areas around there. That's an area that is west of Mosul. And then we still see a fight against ISIS in Syria, a very, very fierce fight. I was just getting some reports on that this morning. And again, we're seeing successes. And, you know, I think, I mean, honestly, I mean, it's my job as a reporter to ask questions, but I think it's a fair question, you know, why did it take us so long to come to these moments? Because one of the reasons it's taken so long to push ISIS out is they had 2 years to settle in. And during that time, there were a lot of atrocities committed. We're just learning more about those. There were, you know, people who have been forced out of their homes were forced to live in camps and tents and cabins and things like that for these 2 years. And whether they'll be able to go back is now a huge question. So success, yes, but a lot of questions and a lot of uncertainty that remains.
Mm. Oh, that's fascinating. Thank you for painting that picture for us, though. And it's tremendous to hear that there has been progress made. It seems we continue to try to understand, I think, as Americans, you know, whether we watch a lot of news or whether we don't watch as much, we see what they do. We hear the stories of what they do. It seems that the dangers we faced for decades in the Middle East under a more conventional, perhaps a brutal dictatorship like Saddam Hussein or the Iranian Ayatollahs, they just don't even prepare us to understand this almost, it seems, unhinged hatred and the barbarism of ISIS. Can you take us behind where these terrorists come from and why they're a different sort of threat?
Well, the leadership of ISIS did evolve from the group Al-Qaeda in Iraq. If you remember during the Iraq War, we saw this insurgency begin really as early as 2004. But over the course of the years following up through 2007, 2008, we saw Al-Qaeda in Iraq grow to be very strong. What happened with ISIS is that they, when U.S. forces in Iraq did push them out, they sort of regrouped in Syria. Syria, you might say, was giving them some safe haven at that time. And they regrouped with former military commanders under Saddam Hussein. And this is a very potent combination. So when we, with the civil war in Syria, we saw the rise of ISIS. And what we saw that was new was that they brought together the what I'll call the jihadi ideology, which is rooted in Islam, rooted in the Quran, that teaches that, you know, the goal of Islam is for the world to become all under the umbrella of Islam, and that many, many forms of making that happen are possible, and they include slavery, and they include beheading, and they include some of the brutalities that we've seen, all in the interest of bringing all this, or really all the world, but certainly all of the Middle East to begin with, under this radical Islamic jihadism. But what we saw with ISIS was not only that ideology, but that ideology married to a number of people with a lot of savvy, a lot of experience in a military organization, in a highly organized dictatorship, which was the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. And so suddenly you had a terror group that had bureaus, that had cabinet members, that had, you know, a department for enslaving women and girls. I mean, I've seen the charts. They truly exist. That put out slips of paper for people. People had to have permission to leave the city of Mosul. And people had to have permission even sometimes to keep their children in their homes and that kind of thing. People had to have permission to go get their hair cut. Things like that. And so this was this very strangely organized and even bureaucratic terror movement. And I think what was new and very frightening, especially for those living in these areas, is that they seized control so quickly. They held control of vast areas. We're talking Mosul, a city of 2 million people, Raqqa, a city of, you know, probably 50 to 60,000 people, and that became their capital in Syria. And this control that spread all the way from these areas of Syria down across Iraq. And so it was, in many ways, unlike anything that we've seen before.
Wow. Mindy Bells is with us. She's senior editor of World Magazine, the author of They Say We Are Infidels, On the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. Ryan Thomas, with you here on the road, one other facet just to sort of set the groundwork here that seems to be somewhat pioneering is their adeptness at using social media and the internet. They are even pulling into Europe and North America using things like Facebook and Twitter. Can you speak to that? This seems to be a new front in the war on terror.
Right, that's right. And, you know, if you remember to the videos that we saw coming out of Syria and some including Christians from Syria and from Iraq, the beheadings that took place, very sophisticated, lots of production capacity, lots of technological savvy. And, you know, behind the scenes for the things that we were seeing in the West is the incredible recruitment effort that you mentioned that's going on, where ISIS, you had ISIS fighters out on the front lines, but then you had ISIS fighters who were sitting at desks and they were 24/7 recruiting, recruiting Muslims from Europe, recruiting wives to come and you know, people to be wives to these guys. And we heard some of those stories, crazy stories, and recruiting and activating people in Europe in particular that led to a lot of the attacks that we've seen in Paris and Brussels and Madrid and that sort of thing.
Oh, it's fascinating. Just fascinating insight here from Mindy Bells. you started off with the good news that ISIS has been beaten back. But in the book, you use the term genocide, and obviously that catches our attention. And I was struck by the fact that it did catch my attention because I've heard that term used so little for what's happening to Christians in the Middle East. Mm. You speak of in terms of a slow genocide that's been secretly infiltrating the Middle East for over a decade. Can you take us behind that phrase?
Yeah, I use that phrase because I think, you know, it really gets at the heart of my book. One of the reasons that I went back and began, the story begins in 2003, the first time I went to Iraq after the U.S. invasion. And what's significant is that at that time, you know, Iraqis, Muslims, and Christians were very optimistic about what was ahead for them. They, their dictatorship had been broken. Saddam Hussein was in hiding. They all talked about this new Iraq, and they expected that Iraq was going to move in a direction that was, you know, that looked something like the United States. The U.S. military was everywhere at that time. But instead, and it's you know, it took a whole book to write it, so I won't try to summarize it. I mean, I will have to summarize it here for you. But instead, what we saw happening was that we just, our military and our political leaders were not astute at what was happening. And I want to give, you know, hindsight of history, it's easy to say that.
Sure.
But in fact, we went into Iraq without, as most of us know, without a game plan for the future, without fully understanding what we were unleashing there. And so this slow genocide that began, the Christians were saying in 2004 they were being targeted. By 2006, you had multiple churches that had been attacked, people kidnapped. In other words, these jihadist groups were going after the most vulnerable, and the most vulnerable that they saw were Christians, and they were going after them because they were, by their ideology, they were allowed to go after. They were told to target them because they were considered infidels. And so at the end of 2006, a priest in Iraq gave me a list of the number of attacks and the number of churches that have been attacked, the number of individuals who have been kidnapped, some released, some killed. And that list, as I started going through it, was 24 pages long. Mm-hmm. And this was at a time we weren't hearing about ISIS. We weren't hearing about Christian persecution in places like Iraq. We had a military there, and we thought that we were winning a war. And in fact, underneath that war, because we weren't paying attention to what the jihadists, the insurgents were after, we were allowing this annihilation of people groups to begin. And the numbers are really stark. At the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003, there's an estimated somewhere between 1 and 1.2 million Christians living in Iraq. And the history of how they've been there and what they've done there is really fascinating. Again, you kind of have to read the book because it takes too long to go into it. But the number is what's important, 1.2 million. By 2014, when ISIS came in to Iraq, there were only about 250,000 Christians left there.
My word.
And now, because of ISIS and because of people being chased from their homelands and kept from them for so long, the church leaders in Iraq tell me they don't think there are more than 100 to 150,000 who remain there. We're talking about an 80 to 90% decrease that has happened under what a lot of people would argue was a U.S. watch. Hmm.
Sobering stuff from Mindy Bells, the senior editor of World Magazine, the author of They Say We Are Infidels, On the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. You know, this is a big question, obviously, but in the time that you spent investigating those stories in that list, can you give us a glimpse into what everyday life is like for those who you interviewed who are forced to live under that ISIS threat?
I think what was remarkable and what made me continue to go back and to continue to report on what was happening to the Christians is that they were persevering and they were continuing with daily life. And, you know, so I lived with a Christian family in 2003 for a week in Baghdad. I continued to follow them over the years. And, you know, that family is still in Baghdad. Numerous family members have been forced to leave. They had family that was forced into the Nineveh Plain area and then also forced out by ISIS in 2014. But you see over and over that people are very committed to staying in their homeland, to continuing to show a Christian witness. And so, you know, on a day that I get reports that there have been bombings, and I hear of churches being targeted, this was happening 2015, 2016, bombings continuing in Baghdad because ISIS cells were trying to stir up trouble there. And, you know, if I would email a church friend there and say, are you okay? How's the church? And are you continuing to have services? One day I got an email back from one of the deacons and he said, yes, we are continuing. We're fine. And he said, in fact, we've added a prayer service from the last time you were here. We now have one prayer service a week where we pray for ourselves, and we have one prayer service a week where we pray for our enemies.
Wow.
And that's kind of a picture of
wow.
how they approach daily life, is that they felt very strongly about, no matter what was happening, no matter how safe their city was or how safe their homes were, they would continue to gather, they would continue to have meals together, they would continue to have worship service together, and to do life as much as they could.
That is extraordinary determination and resilience, and you mentioned it in that answer, but just to dig into it just a little bit more, you said that they felt that it was so important to remain there, even in such dangerous conditions, because they felt it was their duty, essentially, to continue to be a Christian witness. That's remarkable. I mean, what was your reaction to that notion?
I learned a lot from it, because I think that in the West, you know, we don't have those kinds of challenges, and so we don't have the opportunity to explore that kind of perseverance in some ways. I think that they have a lot to teach us. I think that so often when we think of the persecuted church, we think of a church to be pitied. And I think it's much better to refer to them in a way as a persevering church, so that we recognize that being part of their story, people ask me, what can we do? How can we help? And I you know, can come up with practical answers to that. But I think there is a mindset shift that we also need to have, which is not only how can we help, but what can we learn from what they have suffered through? Because we know from Scripture that that's part of, you know, this fellowship of suffering, is not only to enter into the suffering that people have, but also to recognize that it affects us, and how does it affect us, and can it be used for good? And we know that it can, because God promises that He will use it for good.
Yeah.
And so there are just powerful things to, I think, understand and to begin to appreciate. And I think in my own life and in the life of churches that I know and the church that I'm part of, understanding more about the plight of these people, of refugees and of people who have been made homeless by ISIS, people who have seen their churches bombed and many people in their congregations kidnapped and even enslaved. I mean, we're not talking just theoretical. We're talking real, desperate hardship. But the determination they've had to continue as Christians with a public witness, by holding services, by being identified with Christ, by not hiding their identity as Christians, is something that we can appropriate and something that we can do in our own society, in our own neighborhoods, wherever we are.
In these stories, there's so much that is sobering, but there is also as someone who's read the book, there are stories of so much joy as well. Is there a story that you think back to, or maybe a couple stories that's just sort of emblematic for you of this notion of the famous phrase of being surprised by joy? But I imagine you expected to see sobering things, but really, as we go along with you in the story, you continue to see joyful things as well.
I was in Iraq in February of this year. I was able to go to, someone said, well, you should go to the worship service. They'll be worshiping, you know, the Chaldean church will be worshiping at this. And they gave me the time and the place and location. And this is in the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan in Erbil. And I went there, and I'm not sure what I was expecting, Ryan, but I expected to find a beleaguered gathering, people who had been living in tents. I've seen a number of places they live. People have been living in cold, unfinished apartment buildings now for 2, going on 3 years. And I got there, and you could hear the music. As I got out of the cab, I could hear the music. And then I saw the doors were wide open, and there were easily 100 to 200 people standing outside.
Wow.
Who couldn't get in.
Wow.
And a guy that I saw, there was a couple of people there, some that I knew or some that, you know, recognized me because obviously I'm a blonde Westerner, pulled me in and said, come up front, push me up front. And it was a special service, and the Chaldean Archbishop had come to speak to them at some point. But there were, I want to say that there were easily more than 1,000 people there.
Wow.
And it was a cold night. It was a dark night. These are people, I mean, this church was full of people who have lost everything. Their property was under control of ISIS. They had fled without their cars, without their, you know, anything but the coats on their back. And many of them, I mean, we heard stories. Some of the women took off their wedding rings and put them like in baby diapers because they didn't want to have to give them up to ISIS. They were the only thing valuable they had. These were the people who arrived in this area with nothing except their lives. And to see them gathering like that and not discouraged, but singing and holding hands, and, you know, Iraqis are very affectionate people. And so it's wonderful to be in worship with them. This worship service went on for 2 hours. Mm. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, just give me a lot of hope, give me a lot of encouragement just to have the kind of joy that they have in the midst of hard circumstances. And again, the kinds of things that I think make this story so important, because there's a hard road ahead. It is going to take a lot of money and a lot of work, a lot of labor, a lot of material to rebuild these cities where ISIS took control. They destroyed them. And so rebuilding them and helping these people to get back into their homes and to reestablish Christianity and the ancient communities of the Middle East is, to me, a really exciting story and something that we in the United States can get behind. It has a lot of great policy implications for us. You know, we can't even get into that, but it's just a great story and really exciting to think about being part of what's ahead for them, seeing all that they've endured and how they have endured it with joy.
Oh, it is an extraordinary story indeed, told in an extraordinary book called They Say We Are Infidels on the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. Mindy Bells has been sharing just amazing insight with us. She is senior editor of World Magazine and, of course, the author of the book. Mindy, thank you just so much. As you said, there is so much more we could explore, and I wish that we could. But before we do say farewell, don't want to leave without giving you an opportunity. If people are fascinated by this story and just touched, really, by this story, where can they go to pick up a copy of the book?
That's a great question. The book is now out in paperback. So if you visit, you know, a book website like Amazon or anyone's favorite ones. It's available both in hardback and paperback that way. It's sold in Barnes & Noble stores and Christian bookstores and other places, but definitely available on Amazon and on bookseller websites.
Excellent. Well, it has been a real treat to have you here. So many of us have followed your journalism for a long time, and you've been giving us a window into so many just vital stories happening around the world that we might not have a window into otherwise. So it's a real treat to meet you verbally. Thanks again for your time, and keep up the great work.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Thanks for sharing in the story of this latest episode of Faith Radio's On the Road. For more on today's conversation and the full podcast archive of all our episodes, look for On the Road when you visit myfaithradio.com.